This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we look at Bombardier selling off major portions of its commercial aviation business, an FAA emergency airworthiness directive for Boeing 737 airplanes, a United Airlines flight from the perspective of an American Airlines executive, United's Polaris business class, Japanese pilots and alcohol consumption, and visitors to the gate at SeaTac. Also, Launchpad Marzari talks with Red Bull Air Race pilot Patrick Davidson about the Challenger class. Launchpad also interviews Roy Street Losey, instructor pilot with the 307th Bomb Wing, about crosswind landings with a B-52. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 527 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. Hey, David.
Hey, Max. I'm looking forward to our guest tonight because she's my favorite person who hates military aviation, even though I've converted her.
Okay, well, joining us is the aviation queen herself, Binay Wilson. Binay, good to have you back.
Hello, my loyal subjects.
Oh, Max Trescott is off, as we mentioned, as he mentioned last week. He's off in Australia. Yeah, doing Cirrus things. So this episode, it's myself, David, and Binay.
Woo!
Yes. Now, again, this week, we're going without a guest, but we will be adding guests again soon, so nothing to fear. So let's jump right in with some of the aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready.
Ready.
First, we have a couple of articles from AIN Online. First, Bombardier to sell Q400 program to Viking Air. Bombardier announced they're going to sell that turboprop program to Viking Air for $300 million. Viking Air, of course, is a Canadian airframe maker. You think of Viking Air, think of Otters and Twin Otters and Dash 7 and Beaver, the Buffalo and the Aerial Firefighter. Viking holds the original type certificate for all of the out-of-production de Havilland aircraft. With this sale, the CRJ regional jet would be the only commercial aircraft program for Bombardier Aerospace. This, of course, is after they've sold the C-Series program to Airbus. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of a sad day, I guess, in some ways. Don't you think, Binay?
I absolutely do, Max. As you all know, I wrote about the regional airline industry from 1993 to 2001. So I got to see Bombardier up close and personal. I actually attended the rollout of the Q400, and it just feels kind of sad. I mean, they took a gamble on the C-Series, a wonderful airplane, but they just couldn't get everything situated. They didn't have the deep pockets of an Airbus or a Boeing. The Q400, great turboprop, but you know, not a lot of demand for them right now, although it was starting to pick up. It just feels sad.
It does. And not only is Bombardier selling off that program, but they're also selling their business aircraft training business unit. They're selling that to CAE for $645 million. CAE, of course, they have a number of different business interests, but training is, of course, one of the major ones. In the CAE press release, They say Bombardier Business Jets, which at more than 4,800 aircraft, is one of the largest and most valuable in-service fleets of business aircraft in the world. The acquisition will also serve to expand CAE's position in the largest and fastest-growing segment of the business aviation training market, involving medium and large cabin business jets. Bombardier is, quote, streamlining their operation. They're talking about eliminating some 5,000 jobs over the next 12 to 18 months. So, boy, you know, they really are shedding an awful lot of their business here. Presumably, they know what they're doing and have a strategy in mind here, but it certainly sounds like it includes shrinking their commercial aircraft business.
I was reading the AIN online article about the CRJ's prospects. And, you know, when I read about the Q400, and I do want to throw this out, that this story was, in fact, broken by John Ostrower of the Air Current. And it just made me, I read it and I was like, well, the CRJ is the next on the chopping block, but not chopping block, but up for sale. And the first thing I thought is, who would buy this program?
That's a good question. Embraer.
I have a different spin on it a little bit.
All right.
Because I'm impressed with Viking Air. They now have all of the rights to DHC, de Havilland Canada, including the name and logos. So they can produce otters, twin otters, beavers, Dash 7s and Dash 8s, otherwise known as Q400s. So Viking Air has consolidated the whole de Havilland Canada line to put things back into production. So that's pretty awesome, too, that Bombardier sort of bought de Havilland Canada and basically disassembled it. Well, from a historical standpoint, it's nice to know that the de Havilland Canada name and program are back with Viking Air, you know, and they've been really successful with the Twin Otter. So I'm sure they will have some success with the Q400 or bringing back something as simple as the Beaver or the Otter.
Yeah, Viking is interesting. I mean, it's great to see that they're continuing with these really impressive airplanes. I've always been kind of, you know, taken with the Otters, the Twin Otters, that whole class of aircraft. And I wouldn't mind visiting Viking Air someday to check that out. Although, you know, I plugged it into Google Maps and thinking about what about a road trip to Viking Air? How cool would that be? But I learned that'd be a 3,100-mile road trip.
Transcon.
Yeah, so that's probably not in the cards in the near future, but get up in the Seattle area sometime and, you know, a swing over to Viking might be worthwhile. All right, well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the fallout so far from the fatal Lion Air crash. We saw that Boeing released a bulletin concerning certain 737 MAX aircraft, and pretty quickly after that, the FAA turned that into an emergency airworthiness directive. And I will put a link to the actual airworthiness directive in the show notes. It's a PDF. If you're interested in this process or learning about this process, take a look at this. It's basically a pretty quick read. The FAA notes that this emergency AD was prompted by an analysis performed by the manufacturer, that being Boeing, showing that if an erroneously high single angle of attack sensor input is received by the flight control system, there is a potential for repeated nose-down trim commands of the horizontal stabilizer. This condition, if not addressed, could cause the flight crew to have difficulty controlling the airplane and lead to excessive nose-down attitude, significant altitude loss, and possible impact with terrain. So, obviously, we don't have the full results or even very much of the results of the investigation, but at least Boeing and now the FAA think that there is at least some issue with the angle of attack indicators that warrants some action here.
I wonder, does this count as an admission of guilt by Boeing? Are all those people for Indonesian Air going to start suing Boeing?
Not yet. I think it's too early because this kind of addresses the condition and lays out the procedure, the process for pilots to follow if this occurs. And it's worth noting that my understanding is that the directions here for the pilots is not something new. That really, in effect, Boeing is reiterating something that already exists. But it doesn't say anything about the cause. If this is what's going on, what's causing it? Is it a hardware problem? Is it a software problem? Is it a training problem? You know, we don't know right now. All we have is this sort of reiteration of if this condition starts to present itself, how do you handle it? I think the cockpit voice recorder is not yet retrieved as we record this. That'll be, I think, really key to understanding what's going on here, because that would, I think, tell us something about how the pilots responded to this apparent condition.
I'm not sure what's worse, thinking that pilots will, oh, it's that annoying thing, just ignore it and turn it off, or it repeating itself and being a serious problem. I just, this kind of thing just sort of always bothers me that, you know, too many times, you know, to use the term in Vietnam, what they always had a lot of warning signs for anti-aircraft missiles and and they caused so much noise in the cockpit, people would turn them off. Several times I've heard stories of F-105 pilots and F-4 pilots got feet dry, meaning they crossed the beach, and they immediately started switching off things because it was just a distraction from flying. So, you know, sometimes I think we've overcomplicated some of these sensors and et cetera, and this is one of those that's like, there's a lot of Boeing MAX aircraft out there now, and this was a new airplane for all intents and purposes. The new airplane smell hadn't left the cockpit, so
right.
Boeing hopefully will get on the ball and see what's wrong with this as soon as possible.
Yeah, and some questions that I would have, and I'm sure that, you know, this is being looked at, is did other Lion Air 737 MAX aircraft exhibit the same behavior? Did other aircraft of the same type delivered to other airlines around the world, have they exhibited this behavior? You know, is it limited to this particular airplane, or you know, is it something more systemic? And obviously, we don't know what the answer to that question is right now. But you can be sure that that's among the many, many questions that the investigators and Boeing will be looking at.
But if it was only that particular airplane, don't you think Boeing wouldn't have put out that kind of notice?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, what if you didn't know right now if it was just that particular airplane? Well, if you get a notice out to everybody, then you know you're trying to address the problem broadly. You're trying to be conservative. I mean, if I was Boeing, those are the kinds of decisions I would make right now, the most conservative ones, because you certainly don't want another tragic accident like this one to show up until you really know, what the cause is and how to correct it. So I don't know. But on the other hand, David, you know, maybe Boeing does have some evidence that this behavior is showing up in other aircraft. And that's why, don't know.
But, you know, either way, I think it's responsible on Boeing's part to just put out this reminder. I mean, it's probably, you know, it's already out there, but just to kind of remind people as this investigation is going on.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about like another disaster right up Binet's alley.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, come on, Danae. It's our favorite airline.
Well, I when I worked at Delta, I had been there a couple of weeks, and I was in a meeting. And we won't go into all the details of the meeting, but it was a presentation about a reimagining of Delta. This was back in 2004 when, you know, things weren't going so well for Delta. And
and you were so wise at 16, they brought you in? Really?
Oh, you've got jokes.
If you don't think I'm going to have fun tonight, you've got another thing coming.
Oh, gosh, I miss Rob Mark. He used to get all of this. But we had these consultants come in, and they were kind of showing all these pictures, imagining what Delta could look like. And everybody's looking at the pictures, and it's these beautiful watercolor sketches, and everybody's oohing and aahing. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, this airline already exists. And then everybody looked at me. They're like, what? I'm like, it already exists. It's called JetBlue. And they were like, no, they didn't. No, it isn't. And I said, how many of you all have flown on any other airline except for Delta? And one person raised their hand because they had flown on KLM.
That's it, huh?
I mean, that's it. But the point is, I feel with this story, the story is about Elise Eberwein, who's a SVP at American Airlines, and she flew a first class flight on United and did some tweets about her impressions with the service. And when I worked at Rolls-Royce wanted us to fly on our customers. They liked it when we mixed it up because they wanted us, you know, to support our customers, but just to kind of get a view of the service and everything that they're offering. So I applaud Elise for doing this. I wish she had gone into more detail. I can understand why she didn't. But, you know, she had some interesting things to say about her flight, you know, about it was an hour late. We don't know why, didn't say. She thought that their hot towel service was better than Americans. She kind of dinged them for getting rid of screens, and the story from Inc. magazine kind of noted that American actually started this trend. So it was just interesting to kind of get a peek inside an airline executive's view of flying on another airline.
Yeah, I think that flying your competition, to me, makes a lot of sense. I mean, and not from the sort of, you know, industrial espionage standpoint or anything, but just a baseline what your competition is doing. I mean, when I was in the, oh gosh, this goes way, way back, in the retail business, I would often go to the stores of competitors and kind of, you know, look at what kind of merchandise did they have and how were the sales staff approaching customers, you know, all that kind of thing, just to, you know, sort of benchmark the other guys. So I don't think there's any problem, at least to me, in her doing that. In fact, I think it's a great way to run a business, is take a good look at your competition, get outside of your bubble, you know, and see what others are doing. She kind of poked a little bit of fun with some of the tweets. I think some people I can think of might have gone in a much more dramatic direction with impressions in their tweets, but I thought she was, you know, pretty factual and you know, didn't get out of control the way some people do with Twitter.
Yeah, because it's so tempting to just get on and blast, and I mean, you see it all the time now, and it's gotten to the point where I'm just numb to it, and I think the airlines are getting numb to it too, because, you know, you can complain and go on, but it just, after a while, it's just too much. But I do admire the fact that she did do this, and I mean, frankly, I would love to see more airline executives do this exact thing, because you can get very insulated. I remember when I was working at Delta, there were record long security lines at Hartsfield. And I mean, it was, I mean, to the point where people were missing flights and it was just getting a little ugly. And I was in a meeting with some executives and they didn't understand what the problem was. And I was like, well, yes, because you get driven in a car directly to your plane. So you never see any of this.
Yes.
So you might be a little more sympathetic if you actually had to go through the experience like a passenger does. And I'm saying the same thing about when people have to make tight connections in these giant hubs. I think it just behooves you to kind of step out and go on the flights and fly in the middle seat like Jerry Greenwald used to do, the old United Airlines executive. He never sat in business or first. He always sat in coach to kind of, you know, take the temperature. And I think sometimes that can be very helpful.
Yeah, I agree.
Hold it. Before we go on, Max, you had a job before Pratt Whitney in retail. I always got the impression that you graduated diapers and immediately went to Pratt Whitney. What?
No.
I feel so cheated.
No, I had a lot of different jobs. I was kind of a serial entrepreneur for a number of years before I got serious and just stuck with one job. But
a serial entrepreneur, did you stick with the rice side or the corn?
Wheat.
Yeah, I know.
But hey, welcome to an episode of UAV Digest when I'm on fire.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
All right. Binet, United, Polaris Business Class. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, I was fortunate to go to the big rollout in June. Oh, gosh, I want to say it was June of 2014 or 15. I'm sorry, I'm just senile. And they had a big presentation rolling it out in New York City. And they had a mock-up of the cabin, and they had the trays, and it's just, and they had this really cool kind of virtual reality walk through the cabins. And, you know, Oscar Munoz was there and the top executives, and you could talk and interview with people. And, you know, people were excited. I remember at the time thinking that, you know, it was definitely an upgrade. It was, United was catching up. It wasn't like bypassing, but there were some things about it that were really cool. And then in November 2016, they had the opening of the Polaris Lounge at Chicago O'Hare, and more fanfare, more information in the seat and all the amenities. So they start flying, and, you know, just over the past 2 years, it's just been, like the story said, death by a thousand cuts, you know. They were touting the big wine selection. I actually interviewed United Sommelier, and he was so excited about all these new different wines and that people could taste, and they had that little curved thing with the glasses and the champagne with the chocolate and the Bloody Mary cart and mimosa cart, you know, and just the upgraded food. I spoke to the chef from the Trotter Group. I spoke to the Saks Fifth Avenue people with the bedding, and it just seems like it's all just been slowly going away. And it's just sad, you know, because they really pushed this. They had special flight attendant training. They were just doing all of these things. And then I don't know if it stalled. I don't know what.
Yeah, it's hard to say if, you know, this is a matter of them tweaking the product to be more in line with what flyers want, or if, you know, the costs of providing the services has turned out to be more than they could handle, so they've done this as a cost cutting measure, or what? Yeah, I just don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, I applaud them because they were really trying to do something different, but there was just this gap. And I mean, let's just be honest. U.S. carriers are never going to be able to compete with foreign flag carriers that can do all of these things, especially like the big three Middle Eastern carriers, Singapore, Cathay Pacific, Lufthansa, you know, yeah. Airlines with solid first and business class products. And, you know, U.S. carriers, just because of the finances. They're never going to do that. But this seemed to be very promising. And, you know, they're still touting it. And the fact that they had issues with getting the seats in, because everyone hated that 2-4-2 configuration. And I sat in that deadly middle seat. I'm a short person, and I had to crawl over, and I was so afraid I was going to fall on the sleeping person. And those seats, you know, only 20% of the seats, it's been 2 years now, we're going into year three. All of the Polaris lounges that they said were going to open have not opened, although the ones that are open are very popular. I do think they did a really good job with that lounge. I went to the opening of the O'Hara one, and I think they did a pretty good job with those lounges. So it's just going to be interesting to see, you know, where this product will end up.
Yes. Well, you know, hopefully it's someplace where it's providing value to the customers and is also good for United. It's been kind of a long process, it seems. Well, moving on to the next story. This is from the Japan Times. Japan to set up panel to tighten airline pilot drinking rules following recent scandals. Now, the Japanese transport minister says they'll create an expert panel and they'll look at drinking rules for aviation staff. And we've seen a couple of alcohol-related scandals that involved Japanese airline pilots. Just in October this year, a JAL co-pilot was arrested by British police for being about, get this, 10 times over the legal limit. He had been drinking the night before his London to Tokyo flight. And then also in October, an ANA pilot caused flight delays after a drinking adventure in Okinawa. Japan Airlines and ANA, All Nippon Airways, have to report their measures to prevent heavy drinking by airplane staff. It's kind of almost amazing that this is a topic that sort of warrants this level of attention.
Must be one hell of a bunch of karaoke parties the night before these flights.
I was just shocked. I mean, I would have thought that would have been strictly under the Japanese government's purview, the transport department over the transport minister. I'm just shocked that they have left something as serious as alcohol and drinking by flight crews to the airlines. And, you know, not to say that it's the fault of the airlines, but it just seems I'm just surprised that it's being left to the airlines to fix the problem rather than the might of the Japanese government behind it.
I'm more surprised that it's even being acknowledged as a problem. Common sense would, most pilots I know that if they're getting in the seat, they don't touch alcohol for 24 hours before they do. It's really kind of frightening, because it's sort of the amount of problems they've had over the last couple of months means it's a systemic problem in Japan as far as pilots going drinking. I mean, it's a culture problem more than I think a government problem or an airline problem. You know, they have to deal with it, but why is it acceptable for pilots to be doing this to begin with?
Yeah.
It's an excellent question.
Well, and, you know, not to overgeneralize, but back in the day when I was spending a lot of time in Japan with Japanese businessmen, and at that time they were all businessmen, it was very, very typical for them to, you know, put in a good long, hard day's work and then go out, like you say, Dave, to the karaoke bars, to the tempura bars, to the places where they could drink. And, you know, just watching the level of alcohol consumption was, to me, kind of surprising, because I don't know how they, you know, how they made it to work the next morning. I mean, they did, but it was just kind of a pervasive thing. if that extends into the, you know, the aviation industry, and pilots are doing the same, then that's certainly not a good thing. But I guess while in Japan there's prohibition against drinking alcohol so many hours before flight time, there's apparently not a specific like blood alcohol level requirement, not a regulatory one certainly. And that's a little bit different than, you know, you see in other countries. So, you know, maybe that's something that's about to change in Japan.
I certainly hope so, because, I mean, thank goodness these people were taken off or weren't allowed to get on a plane before, you know, before takeoff, because you can only imagine what could have happened.
Yeah, that creates a dangerous situation, unnecessarily. All right, in Market Watch, I like this one. Seattle Airport hopes to let friends and family meet passengers at gate, among the first of a post-9/11 trend, it asks. Now, of course, after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, airport security changed forever. But maybe we're seeing kind of a lifting of one restriction. Now, SeaTac, of course, the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, is proposing a visitor pass program. And this is where, after a TSA screening, people without tickets could gain entry into the domestic travel gates, which is exciting. Of course, now, if you don't have a ticket, you can't go through security. I think this is an interesting change in the rules. Now, this is a pilot program, but interesting nonetheless. I don't know. Do you guys think this is a good idea, a bad idea? Any thoughts?
I think it's a great idea. I mean, I remember being able to go past the gate and sit with friends and family, you know, have a meal, you know, watch the planes. I think that's a great idea. And a lot of airports were hurt after 9/11 because they lost a lot of that traffic. Now, they've adjusted accordingly, obviously. But I think anything that lets people kind of be with their friends and family and enjoy airports again, as long as they go through the screening. I mean, I have global entry. I would love to be able to just go through and hang out and leave. And I just think it's a good idea. I mean, Detroit Metro Airport had a small program where they had a Westin hotel attached to the airport. And they got a waiver that allowed their hotel passengers who were going on a flight to go through security, go through TSA screening, and go in, you know, to dine and to shop. And, you know, I know they're doing it in Pittsburgh now. So I don't think this is a bad thing.
My suggestion would be this. The first people you allow to do that is any military, active, or reserve that are coming home from overseas deployments. The sooner their families can see those loved ones, the better.
Hmm. Applause, applause.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. That's interesting. The Port of Seattle commissioner he's noted that it's been 17 years since anyone without a ticket has been able to enjoy areas of airport security or the airport beyond security. And yet some of the airport's best features are there. He says great restaurants, local musicians performing in the concourses, and some of the best views of the planes coming and going against the backdrop of Mount Rainier and the Olympics. He says for now, this is a pilot program, but we're excited to see if this is something the public is interested in. Now there are some rules. And according to the airport, if you want to do this, you have to apply online before 1:30 p.m. the day before you want to visit the airport. So it's not just a walk up and walk in. As we said, visitors must be approved by the TSA. They'll be notified of their approval status by midnight the day before they enter. It says enrollment is available Monday through Friday, 7:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. few other things. Here's an interesting one. The program is limited to 50 visitors per day. So they're capping the number of people, at least for this pilot program, to 50. Approved visitors will go through the standard security checkpoints. So all security requirements for any traveler will be in place for visitors as well. And of course, this is only for domestic arrivals. So that kills David's idea.
No, active duty military would be, I think you could carve out for an international arrival. Because most likely they'll be on a domestic airline anyway.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm. See, Binet and I got this marked out, dude.
All right.
We got this planned. We got the, I mean, us military brats have got to stick together.
That's right.
All right. We have a couple of recordings from our reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. And the first one is an interview with Patrick Davison, Red Bull Challenger 77. Now, the Red Bull Air Races has two classes. There's the master class, which is pretty much everything everybody has talked about when they talk about the Red Bull Air Races. But there's also this Challenger class. This is kind of designed to bring newer pilots into the series, sort of a supporting race. It has some different rules. Although for 2018, they changed the aircraft. They're going to be flying the Edge 540 V2 race planes instead of the extra 330 LXs. There's some other changes as well. But let's listen to Launchpad Marzari and Patrick Davison.
Hello, Airplane Geeks listeners. Hey, I want to apologize for the sound quality. I ran into Patrick Davis Challenger in the Red Bull Air Races, and just as we started the interview, the booth next to us fired up their PA system, and we couldn't move away. So it sounds like we're doing an interview inside a rave. I will attempt to do better for you guys next time. But for now, here's our interview with Red Bull Air Racer, Patrick Davison. And remember, the Red Bull Air Race is in Dallas this weekend, 17 and 18 November. Hey, Airplane Geeks. I'm here with
Patrick Davison from the Red Bull Air Race.
And you're racer number what?
I'm Challenger 77.
And you're here in America because...
Yeah, we're promoting a Red Bull Air Race in Dallas on the 17th and 18th of November.
Well, that's just around the corner. Cool. Now, you're from South Africa, correct? So our international... All right, let's get geeky for a moment. How are you legally flying in America?
Yeah, good question. So I had to come across to America and do a standalone commercial license. And the airplanes, the Edge 540s, which we fly, they're all November registered. So hence the reason I'm able to do so.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the airplanes. That's a good... Because you're not flying your own airplanes, correct? In the Challenger series, you guys are flying...
Yeah, we got three Edge 540s V2s, and what it is there's number one, number two, and number three, which are supposedly all exactly the same, but completely different. And there's 10 challenges, and each race we have between six and seven pilots, and we bounce between number one, two, and three. So it's luck of the draw which one you get for whichever race.
Now, will you fly the same aircraft for the whole weekend?
Yeah, I mean, if you're lucky enough that there's no technical failure, then yeah, you'll fly the same airplane from when you arrive in the venue or at the venue until when you leave or after the race. But we have had it in the past where we've had small technical issues which have forced the pilots to fly alternate airplanes on race day, which obviously throws a big spanner in the works.
Speaking of the aircraft, we're looking at one right here, and you've got these blades, for lack of a better word, that are sticking out from the wingtips.
Yeah, I mean, they use those what we call pylon cutters. So if you take a big pylon hit, you know, if you get too close or you drift in or you get a bad line and you end up hitting it with a vertical stab or, you know, possibly even the wing, there's a good possibility it could get tangled up in one of the control surfaces, which could become a really big problem. So, yeah, we put the cutters on the aeroplane to hopefully separate the material and, you know, get it away from the control surfaces or at least minimize whatever's coverage on the controls.
Right, and these are like the wire cutters we see on helicopters.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, if you ever have a look at a pylon, you'll see that it's almost like as thin as paper. You know, once it's got the air rushing through it and it's running at a specific pressure, it tears really, really easily. But depending on how deep you hit it and at what speed and at what height of the pylon, the lower it is, the thicker it is, so it could be detrimental. So, yeah, the plan is to work like a Stanley knife and just to cut it away.
Okay. Now, how did you come to be a Red Bull Challenger?
Yeah, I got lucky, I guess. I built up a bit of a reputation for myself in the competition aerobatic circuit, my Fly Unlimited, and, you know, I won a few contests and, yeah, basically made contact with Red Bull South Africa, and they in turn proposed me to Red Bull Air Race. I was then invited to a qualification camp in Austria, which I went across. I did pretty well. They invited me back for a conversion camp, for lack of a better word, onto the Edge 540. And, yeah, here I am.
So they recruited you.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I carry the Red Bull sponsorship in South Africa. I'm sponsored by both Hella and Red Bull in South Africa. And with the affiliation, I suppose right place, right time is a good old saying that, they were looking for a representative for the South African market, and I was lucky enough to be that guy.
Okay, and if they want to find out more about buying tickets or just about racing, where would they go?
So, yeah, you can go into redbullairrace.com. And then, you can also follow me at Flying Davidson. That's my handle. So, yeah, we're pretty social media pro. So, yeah, basically all the information that they forward on to us as pilots, we forward on our social media channels. So be sure to follow.
Well, now you got something to put on your calendars, Airplane Geeks listeners. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
I don't know, I kind of like that background music added to the atmosphere.
I was dancing.
Yeah. Oh, but boy, you know, these air races, this is a business, right? And to make no mistake about it, I mean, you know, just when you think about the fact that it's, you know, it's more than just one race series, you know, it's two basically. You know, trying to bring pilots along to compete in the main class, the master class. This is quite a big operation. We'll have some links in the show notes. The last race this season is coming up just in a few days after we record this. So hopefully there'll be a lot of airplane geeks participating there. All right. Benet, what's new with you these days? Get us caught up a little bit on your activities.
I'm just living the dream, Max. I am kind of still recovering. The Princess of Planes turned 13 yesterday.
My.
Yes, and it has been the fastest 13 years of my life. But I'm very proud of her. She's just quite the young lady, taller than her mother. It's just ridiculous. I'm going to send you a photo if you want to use. There's a lovely picture of Max with my child when she was 3 years old.
That was really, it was that long ago?
It was that long ago.
Oh, yeah. Send it along. We'll put it in the show notes.
Oh. Yes. And other than that, I'm still doing some freelance writing, but, you know, I have the day job now where I do travel and rewards coverage for MagnifyMoney.com and CompareCards.com. So I'm really enjoying that, but I still have my hand in the aviation stuff. So, you know, I have no complaints.
Great. David, we're kind of winding down in the year in 2018. Shockingly, it seems like it went by so fast. But when you look ahead to next year, any events, aviation events or air shows or anything that you sort of have your eye on? Dave is on mute. Maybe David's still on mute.
Oh, goodness.
Maybe David left the building.
Well, if I were David, I would say I look forward to all of the military air shows.
Yeah. Do you think you'll attend some next year?
If I were David, yes, I would. Actually, though, I would. I grew up my high school years in D.C., and my dad always took us to the air show at Andrews Air Force Base, which was always, and I know it's called Joint Andrews. That just drives me nuts. But
Joint Base Andrews Air Force. Joint Base Andrews.
I know. I hate that.
It just sounds so weird.
Yes, exactly.
It's like it's out of order.
Yes. We lived at Bowling Air Force Base, and now it's Joint Bowl. I'm like, what? Really?
Okay.
Bottom line is this. When they decided just before in the late 90s, they decided that these bases that were clearly next to each other should be consolidated. And the reason why they got combined was because they now have a joint administration staff for the two bases. So, for example, originally you had Andrews Air Force Base. And on the other side of the Andrews Air Force Base was the Naval Air Facility Andrews, right? And it was two different bases. Likewise, at Willow Grove, we had the Willow Grove Naval Air Station, and then we had the Air Force Reserve Station at Willow Grove. They were two separate bases. They had equal administration for both things. So my dad's snowplows were used by the Navy, even though he owned the snowplows. So they started combining all of these bases, like Joint Base Langley-Eustis. You've got up in Alaska now, it's the two bases are combined, right? And then, of course, you have the one that's really confusing, which is Joint Base McGuire-Dix-Lakehurst, it's just better to call it JBMDL. For all of us old school people, it's a tough pill to swallow. Air Force bases are Air Force bases. Army bases are forts, you know. So it's navies or naval stations.
I understand combining the bases. That's fine. My problem with it is the title of the place. And it just seems to me like the word base should be the last part of the title, not stuck somewhere up front. It's like you're saying it backwards.
Yes.
Joint Reserve Base Willow Grove. I know. It's Joint Reserve. I get it. The other really obnoxious part of the joint base part, and this is the real truth, if you put joint base first, none of the services get hurt that they weren't the first base mentioned.
Yeah. Do you think that's an outcome, or do you think that's a reason for
the naming? Think that's an absolute reason. And the other reason is the first base in the order of the joint bases is the one that has the primary management of the facility. In the case of Joint Base McGuire-Dix-Lakehurst, McGuire Air Force Base is the one that runs the other two bases.
All right. Well, that makes sense. I mean,
sorry. That's for all of those people who like general aviation and airliners. I apologize.
And so do I. But we're sensitive about this. Damn it.
I'm Binet, you're sensitive about it. You can imagine what it was like when I grew up, when my father had his own Air Force Reserve Station, and everybody said, oh, well, it's Willow Grove Naval Air Station. I'm like, no, it's the Willow Grove Air Force Reserve Station. So no one even realized that there was two different bases that shared a runway at Willow Grove. So I'm hypersensitive to this whole combination thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess there's probably, Binet, there's probably bigger issues in this world to be irritated by, but I don't know. It's kind of fun to poke
Max,
at that one.
We talked about United already. Okay, can Danae and I bond over something else?
Okay. So David, do you have any plans for next year for events to attend?
I do. I'm sorry for people who are going to hear me say this and they're going to freak out, but my favorite demonstration team is coming across the pond, and I will do everything in my power to see them at least once. And that's the Royal Air Force Red Arrows will be in the United States on tour, on a North American tour in August through October. So I will figure out some place to see them. When they were here at Langley, I discovered I had a new favorite jet team. And to be honest, I know why. It's because I ignore the Blue Angels anymore, and I ignore the Thunderbirds because I've seen them.
Stop.
I have
you
seen them.
You just say ignore the Thunderbirds?
I will be in the car and outside of the base before they take off.
That is heresy.
Oh, David.
The Blue Angels?
David.
Yeah, I can get over that. The Thunderbirds?
Oh, no. See, if you're gonna make me choose between the two, the Blues are a better team. Now,
I have my fists clenched. I'm ready to fight.
I know. But when I saw the Red Arrows at Langley, they gave me a sense of wonder and childhood delight because of one thing. I didn't know the routine. I know the Snowbirds routine by heart. I know the Thunderbirds by heart. I know the Blue Angels by heart. I know that when I was at Dover and I stayed to see the Thunderbird show, I made it a perfect point to note that the number four ship taxied to the end of the runway as a single seat and took off as a two. And I knew how they did it. I'm jaded that way. I get it. But I definitely will make an effort to see the Red Arrows wherever they are next year, just because it's an amazing team. Like the Snowbirds, it's just different, you know. It's unique. And when I found out they were coming, I was like, okay. I called my friend Dave. I said, we need to plan be prepared to plan a road trip because that's what I'm looking forward to seeing next year on air show season.
All right.
Okay. I guess you guys never thought that David and I would have this much military chatter going on.
Of course. Well, you and I did.
I guess proof positive that this podcast is not scripted. All right. But hey, we do have another military item here. You know, we've talked about David, haven't we talked about the way that the B-52 landing gear can be turned, angled for
crabbed?
Well, Launchpad Merzari caught up with an instructor pilot from the 307th Bomb Wing, and they talk about crabbing a B-52. So let's listen to this.
Hello, Airplane Geeks listeners. Today I'm with
Roy Street Losey, the instructor pilot on the B-52 from the 307th Bomb Wing at Barksdale Air Force Base.
Very cool, and we're here at the Alliance Air Show. And since we're with the instructor pilot, let's get geeky and start talking very specifics. Let's talk about crab landing. The B-52 has the ability to land in a crab.
That's right. So unlike normal airplanes that slip into the wind and then have to kind of twist around in order to land straight on the runway, our aircraft has it's a really unique system on the landing gear that all of the gear will turn and line up straight with the runway, while the aircraft itself will actually land sideways and on the runway. We actually will land sideways and look out the side window sometimes to land.
Okay. Now, is the landing gear free castering, or are you having to dial that in?
Right. So the system is called the Crosswind Crab Pre-Alignment System. What it does is we'll set it. We can set it from the cockpit once we learn what the landing winds are. We'll set it as part of our landing checklist. And when we turn the system, all four gears will turn, and they'll set to a new centered position, and that's where the runway is supposed to be lined up even with the gear at that point. So they will be lined up fixed straight down the runway if you do it right.
Okay, so we're coming in. We've determined that based on the crosswind, we're going to be canted off about 10 degrees. So we dial in 10 degrees to the landing gear. Mm-hmm. What does that do to rudder pedal authority once you've touched down?
Right. So when you set the crab system to whatever that new setting is, 10 degrees, let's say, to the left, you lose some of your ability to steer. So it's a new neutral, basically. So you won't have as much rudder authority in one direction as you do in the other. So basically it turns the whole thing a little bit. You lose some of your ability, which makes sense because you wouldn't want to go any farther to the left if you're already set a little bit left, if that makes sense.
Okay. Now, when you're rudder turning, are you steering all four landing gear, or just the front two, or just the back two?
Right. So while the crab pre-alignment system will turn all four gear, the only thing that is affected by rudder inputs is the two forward gear, right? So those are the only ones that will turn when we're on the ground that we steer with.
All right. Now, what about, do you have toe brakes? Can you do left and right braking? How does that work?
So the B-52 does not have differential braking, much like maybe a Cessna would. If you push left, you'll get some left brake. It's an even amount of braking to all four brakes when you apply pressure to either of the toe brakes. There's no real differential braking, right?
Okay. Now, we're landing in our, keep our scenario going at this 10-degree crab, mm-hmm. and we're going to land nice in a 10-degree crab, our wheels are set. What about our tip wings and the landing gear that's out on at the far end of the wingtips?
Right. So we don't consider those necessarily a primary gear. Those are what we call tip protection gear. It's only designed to prevent the wingtip and the associated external fuel tank from striking the ground, because it's such low to the ground when it's on the ground, it's pretty low. So that gear is out there only to protect the gear or the tips of the wing from striking the ground. Really, now they do not align. They don't turn. We have no ability from the cockpit to turn the actual tip protection gear. They're just free caster.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say they just free caster. They're not fixed.
That's right. So, we do have an indication when we're taxiing that the tip gear might not be aligned with the aircraft. It's called tip gear, not in trail. We'll get a little warning light. That just means that the gear itself is not streamlined with the aircraft, might be at an angle. And if it came down, maybe whatever, contacted the ground for whatever reason, it might damage the aircraft. So we should straighten it out before we continue. And sometimes we have to get a guy out with a bar to kind of turn it and make it straight again.
Okay, we've landed. We've gone to the end of the runway, and we're going to start taxiing back. How do we take the crab out?
Okay, so once we've slowed down to taxi speed, while we're still on the runway, before we turn off, the checklist step is to, there's a button you push right by the knob that you use to set it that will center the crab. It's just an automatic, you hold it until it lines back up, and then it's basically a normal airplane again with centered up gear.
I take it you need to be rolling when you do that.
You do. If you don't, it'll just twist right on and tear up the tires. So you do need to be rolling. Much like when you steer the aircraft, you should steer it while it's rolling also to prevent damage to the tires. Yeah.
Oh, you can tell we're at an air show. Here comes somebody rolling down the runway with converting lots of kerosene to noise. Okay, now, there's a couple of them. You've taxied all the way down and you're going to do takeoff. Do you dial in a crab for takeoff?
So you do, you do. There is a pre-alignment, much like for landing. There's also one for takeoff. So if there's a crosswind, as you start to roll for takeoff, one of the checklist steps is to set the crab for takeoff. So when you're on the runway, if there's a strong crosswind, you'll be looking out a side window again down the runway. The aircraft will actually be sideways on the runway a little bit.
when you retract, do you have to realign it before you retract, or will it align itself first?
Right. So when you put the gear handle up, automatically the gear will center and then retract. So it won't retract until all the gear is centered. So when you have crab set in the gear, retraction takes just a little bit longer because those gears are centering. Each individual gear centers and then retracts in sequence.
Well, okay, we've gotten real geeky about landing gear on B-52s. I'd like to thank our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Callsign Street, and there you go. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
All right. Thank you, Launchpad. That's a really interesting system, David.
And it was probably the most classified system on the B-52.
Is that right?
When it first came out. It was a very unique system for you know, and it's surprising that other aircraft have never taken it up. But it's a very unique system to the B-52, and B-52 takeoffs and B-52 landings, if you've never witnessed one, are very unique. B-52s, when they take off, have an interesting nose down takeoff. They lift off the ground, and immediately the nose sort of goes nose down as it picks up speed to climb out. So it's a very flat landing also. And, of course, it's got a very large drag chute, a very large drag chute.
Yes.
So if you ever get a chance to see B-52s coming in or taking off, now, mind you, the good old days when we had minimum interval takeoffs or METOs, where you would have 20 B-52s taking off within a matter of minutes, that would be just if you want to watch smoke being generated quicker than you could possibly imagine, go to YouTube and put in the word MITO, or minimum interval takeoff, which was a Strategic Air Command, and there's a lot of videos out there, B-52s and B-47s, where you see guys running from their bunks, getting in their cab trucks. One of those things that most people don't realize is the cab pickup truck, or otherwise known as the crew cab pickup truck, was because of Strategic Air Command. Strategic Air Command wanted to be able to deliver a B-52 crew as well as any chocks, etc., out to the B-52. So they created a dual cab pickup truck, commonly known as a crew cab. The crew meant B-52. And how's that for a bit of dark trivia?
Wow. That's impressive.
That's where you get the term crew cab. It was from the Strategic Air Command.
Huh. Okay. A few listener mails we might mention. We heard from Patrick Wiggins. He tried to send us a YouTube video featuring the head of SpaceX speaking at the 2018 AOPA High School Aviation STEM Symposium. But somehow the video disappeared from everywhere. So we don't have that. But we'll put a couple of other links in the show notes from this AOPA STEM Symposium. This is a great, great thing that AOPA is doing. It's a program for high schools to bring STEM. And they just recently held their symposium for educators and others, I think. I think this was in Louisville. So we've got that for the show notes. Also, we heard from Gustav in Sweden. Now, you'll recall we asked last episode for people to let us know, share with you, some of the favorite aviation-related YouTube channels that they watch. And Gustav introduced us to Kermit Weeks Hangar, which is just fantastic. Gustav said they just finished listening to the last episode, 526, and asking about favorite YouTube channels. He said, I have many, but one that I want to share with my fellow listeners is Kermit Weeks' channel. He has a saying, when I grow up, I want to be me. A fact that no one can argue with, he said. This is a great channel. Of course, Kermit Weeks I guess, the originator of the Fantasy of Flight Museum, a longtime aviator, started building planes when he was a kid. A really interesting guy. And Gustav suggests that maybe Kermit would be a great guest for this show, and I agree with him. So maybe we'll try to reach out to Kermit, or if any of you listening have a good connection to Kermit, give us an introduction. That would be great, and we'll see if we can get him on the show. So good idea. And again, if any of you have some really favorite aviation-related YouTube channels, write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll share them with everyone.
So, Binet, do you?
You know what? I could go down the rabbit hole on YouTube aviation videos for the rest of my life and never do another thing.
Yeah, there's a lot out there. But most of the YouTube channels I subscribe to, the things like podcasting channels and, audio recording channels.
I was going to say, you've been obsessed about podcasting.
It's really pathological, I think. But yeah, because I run across the odd individual video, aviation video from time to time. There really aren't any specific channels that are devoted to aviation that I follow. So if you do, let us know. We'll pass them on. All right. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, this is another abbreviated episode without a guest. I promise you, I miss having the guests as much as you probably do. And we'll restart those shortly. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's it. airplanegeeks.com/527. And let's tell folks where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, where do we find more David online?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog. Now that I'm unemployed, I'm blogging again. You can find me Thursday night at my Heroes concert, Alan Parsons. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking drones on the UAV Digest.
All right. And Binet Wilson, where do folks find you?
Hi. You can find me on Twitter at AvQueenBinet, B-E-N-E-T. You can find me on the Instagram. I've gotten really active on Instagram as Aviation Queen. I have an Aviation Queen Facebook page, and yes, kids, I'm still hanging in there on Google+.
They're going to kill that.
Yes, I know.
Google's going to turn that off. Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a valiant effort. We had an Airplane Geeks Google+ page for a while, but it was just filled with spam, and so we just got rid of it.
Yep.
Slack is where the action is these days, and not just for us. We were kind of one of the early groups to get into Slack and start up a team that has just grown by leaps and bounds. I mean, Slack in general has to quite a large operation. But I like our Slack team because, it's kind of a closed community. You have to request an invitation, and we only let people know that on the podcast itself, not on the webpage, not in other places which might capture or draw in a lot of people that aren't really the kind of the hardcore. It's nice. It's an interesting place. Kind of my preferred social media venue these days. So, all right. Well, with that, let's say you can find me. Well, you can find me on the Slack team. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. I'm also on LinkedIn, as David said, over at the UAVDigest.com, and also with Mary Kirby at PaxexPodcast.com. That's PAXEX Podcast.com. We talk about the passenger experience. Our outro music is by Bruno Massone. He takes aviation sounds and he kind of mixes and combines them in with other musical compositions. You can find his work at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening.